What is happening? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock. Oh, and today's guest, look at this. We have Enosaurus. Guys, Enosaurus is here. Welcome, Eno. Thank you so much for joining The Craft.
Thank you for having me. And for waiting for me to...
No, that was wonderful.
While I did Excel work with this on the line, that was...
Look,
exciting for you, I'm sure.
Actually, it was, because here's the thing. I don't think people understand enough. Like, we don't just say, I wonder what this thing is, and then it just pops into our head. Every time we talk about data, every time we talk about these players and what is good, what is bad, it takes research that can be so obnoxious. I have certainly given myself the luxury of having Kyle Bland on the pitcher staff. If I have a question, I just say, Kyle, tell me this. But here's Eno for the last, I don't know, 5 minutes or so. He comes in and I just hear frustrations.
The most annoying thing in the world is the fact that Savant puts their player names as last name, comma, first name.
Ah, yes.
And then for pitchers, throws RHP and LHP on there. And there's spacing. There's spaces in there. So I kept staring at this being like, why isn't it working? And it's like, oh, there's two spaces there instead of one space.
Oh, my God.
Two spaces instead of one space? What? So, yes, that's what I was yelling about.
Oh, my gosh. It was really fun to see. And we're like, it's fun for me because I'm actually working on a project to hopefully alleviate some of these frustrations for you. And I'll have more to talk about that kind of later this year. And it's for 2025. But I'm in that mode of like, okay, cool. How are we talking about data, subject groups and subject group filters and stats and stats filters? And you had a very interesting query. So what was causing all this frustration, really?
Well, let me set it up. I was talking to John Gray, who I really enjoy talking to. I don't really know why, but we like he's not the most cerebral guy in the world in terms of his craft and stuff, and he hasn't changed that much, so it's not like I can always be like, ooh. But this year I just noticed a really small thing, which was that the horizontal movement as fastball had changed a little bit. And he said that's because of locations, not necessarily mechanics. And I will have a larger, piece on this, or at least it'll go in my notes column, where I'll explore that with some of his other pitches. But with his fastball in particular, that was fascinating to me. And I went and I looked, and he has a four-inch difference. Let me find him here. Yeah, 5-inch difference horizontally on his fastball, depending on if he's throwing it into lefties or into righties.
Man.
And actually, he's kind of cool because he has a 2-inch difference on vert. So when he throws his four seam to lefties, it's has 2 inches more IVB and 5 inches less horizontal. So it's basically more four seam like.
It's and still this not- is a glove side for him.
Yes, it's still not great.
Yeah,
it's still not plus IVB, but it's much more of a four seam shape.
Right.
And then when he throws it in on righties, he gets more of that horizontal shape and more drop, and 2 inches more drop.
My instinct of that is like wrist position and also staying, like you call the extension side with Hunter Brown, right? So you're on it longer.
Yes, I think it's more the latter than the former, because he talked about the timing of his arm depending on what side he's throwing to.
Right
So he says he's a little bit later, I think, when he's going to inside to righties, and so that gives him more of that sinkerish
Right. And I mean, that also when in your, this is actually a major thing about fatigued arms, is that when your arm is lagging in any way, you are going to have a lower arm angle because it's just more effort to get on top. So because it's a lower arm angle, and it's not necessarily wrist position, but you are then going to be more on the side of the ball, which is why then you do see like the up and away locations when you have arm fatigue later in the game, you see that. So that's really interesting stuff from John Gray.
And then generally also, if you're talking about breaking balls, those release points are a little bit, you're trying to be out in front of those, right?
Yeah.
So right. It would make sense that if you're throwing a fastball to the glove side, that you might have more cut because you're staying with that longer.
Yep. Yeah.
You know,
that's a huge, so last week, Tyone, I got to hang out with him on the field. That was absurd. But he talked exactly about that with his sweeper. And even what I thought was so interesting was he was talking about even his mechanics being slightly different when he's throwing a sweeper versus his four seamer.
Yeah,
like staying more closed just a little bit more so that he can then feel slightly his arm come around
a little bit. Like he's
right. I joke that like, hey, you should bring Jake Arrieta into town. but it's just like it's a very subtle thing. It's not. I don't think it's something that batters would be able to like get as like a tip or something like that.
It's more like
It's about really the pelvic motion, right? Like the just feeling a little bit close on that. We talked about Mackenzie Gore a little after what you mentioned about that too.
Yeah.
But really was expressing so much about his feel of the sweeper coming out with his wrist on the other side of the ball, as opposed to the wrist behind the ball, right? Mm. That finger coming out and around it and tugging it and pulling it with him. And there's a lot to that.
So the query that I was wrestling with was just trying to compare horizontal movements to the glove side and arm side.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see who had the biggest difference and the smallest differences, really, between those two. And I think number one is so supremely obvious that maybe you could guess.
I mean, the one that is famous, I think, is Max Fried.
Oh, yeah. Where is Fried on this? Oh, I don't think... I had, because of snafus, this is only people who've pitched a lot.
What?
Yeah, I had to do 50.
How could you do this to me?
Because I had to limit it to 50 fastballs to each side. I don't know if...
All right, well, hold on a second. I'm thinking about a guy who is east-west.
Somebody who throws a ton of fastballs and has 80 different fastballs.
There's like Justin Steele, for example. But that's probably too limited, too. Yeah, too limited. Wheeler.
The king of different fastballs, Lance Lynn.
Oh, fine. Yeah. I don't think about Lance Lynn much anymore.
I know. Okay. But I think we should. I mean, he's really interesting because, I think there's a little bit of a trend here. There's guys who buck the trend, but there's something here to think about, I think. So Lance Lynn, 14 inches difference.
Of horizontal. Whoa. Is that right? As Eno leans into the camera as he's staring at his spreadsheet. Whenever you see anyone who's interested in data lean in like this, you know it's good. Okay? Everyone knows exactly what I'm talking about. You've been in those Zoom meetings where like someone brings up a point and then they just lean closer to the monitor. I'm even seeing Eno move his lips quietly as he has a thought. But I mean, if Lance Lynn is doing that, I've always considered Lance Lynn's four seamer as more of a cutter than I do a true four seamer. So it does not surprise me that in certain moments he does get more lift on it. That would speak to the higher swing strike rates that we get. And obviously being different in major ways is also like, right, that's how guys are missing this one a ton because it has different movement profiles.
Yes, I had it wrong. Lance Lynn is about the same. That's crazy.
All right, never mind.
The guy with the biggest difference is Nestor Cortes.
Oh, interesting.
On the right side, it's Gray Flaherty Heel.
Which Bidey, Gray?
Peralta.
There's three Grays.
John Gray, my guy.
Okay.
Ryan Pepio. So for righties, it's like Peralta, Bibee. So what I thought would be the trend is Jack Flaherty, John Gray, Wheeler is on there actually. Those guys are smaller arsenals. At least Gray, Flaherty, and Heel are smaller arsenals.
Yeah.
On the other side, it's lefties, Crochet, Gore, Reagans, and Cortez. So those are not necessarily Gore isn't Reagan's is only about an inch. Cortez is two and a half inches. And I think he's kind of a smaller arsenal. Crochet is kind of a smaller arsenal. I mean, it's like cutter slider for Crochet, yeah. Right? Like the changeup's not, you know.
I'm curious. Who is the most over the top release of these guys?
Freddie Peralta has a 2-inch difference.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking generally I think these guys are flatter four seamers. I mean,
yes.
Right.
What's the best IVB on any four seam on here is Luis Gil.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe Freddie Peralta actually.
Oh yeah.
But generally it doesn't surprise me if there's more three quarters than there are, straight over the top guys like Tanner Bibee won't be on here. Right. I don't think so.
He is.
He is
2 inches.
2 inches difference.
Yeah.
Horizontally.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's not the largest shift in my view.
But that's the largest in my data set. 50 each side. We've got 2.1 is Ryan Pepiot. Mm-hmm. 2.1 is Joe Boyle. 2 is Freddie Peralta. 1.9 is Tanner Bibee. Nestor Cortez is 2.4.
Take it all back. Theory gone.
Logan Allen is 2 on the other side. And those are the biggest in my data set. Now, my data set is only 23 pitchers because you have to throw 54 seams to both sides.
But
I think that's good. I'll open it up to 25 four seams to both sides, but I don't want it to be smaller than 25 because 25 is about where Stuff Plus stabilizes for us.
Sure.
And I like Tom Tango has this rule that you should have 30 in every sample. And I actually talked to a statistician that was like, that's weird, but it's funny and it's kind of true.
You know, by the way, really small tangent here. I brought someone to a baseball game who doesn't really know baseball at all, but is like a software engineer. So they love data. And they saw on the Mets scoreboard that they instead of batting average, which they knew, it was OPS. And she said, okay, what is this? And I said, well, it's the on-base percentage plus slugging. And I was like, what's the denominator? I was like, well.
Oh, boy.
And she's like, this is fake math. And I was like, you're not wrong. You're not wrong.
You know, the funniest thing about OPS is that despite all that, it's like pretty predictive. It's pretty powerful.
Right. Tango hates it, too. I remember that. Yeah. Like, this is a terrible. It's just an arbitrary thing. And that's why like I think of Tom Tango like arbitrary of like the 30 pitches or whatever. I'm like, yeah, I understand. We do things like that at times, but OPS is kind of good still. It's weird. I mean, it's like 4 times almost like what slugging into on-base percentages, right? Like if you have like a 4,000 to a 1,000 or something, but I know it's not quite the same. It's weird.
I bet you that the thing that like links these guys is something small mechanically that we don't know about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like some. Yeah. Like if we had like biomechanical metrics, there would be something that they do common that, you know, that allows.
Is it extension? No. Extension like Peralta. I know Gray does that. I know Crochet.
Gray has good extension.
I think he does.
Crochet does.
Yeah. I think that's what helps out Gray's fastball the most.
Well, I'll look at it a little bit more, but it's fascinating to me that that's the idea. And that's why I thought, of course, Lance Lynn should be on here. But the thing is that Lance Lynn actually has so many different fastballs that he doesn't have to change them. So really, the common thread here among those guys is we think of them as having a four seam, and yet there are different characteristics on that four seam from side to side. I'm sure. Yeah. That Fried will show on this list once I
Fried, absolutely. That was the whole thing. I remember the Juan Soto interview about it. And it's more of a cutter inside, glove side, and it's a two-seamer inside. Arm side. By the way, John Gray is a 6.7 extension, so slightly above average. I take that back.
I think this is also like why, you know, if you think about it, sometimes I think it's interesting that like, you know, Stuff Plus is really powerful within 500 pitches. But then after that, K-minus BB starts to take over. And one of the reasons why I think K-BB is so powerful is because, you know, Stuff Plus will not figure out that John, like it'll look at John Gray's fastballs and it'll say, these are pretty crappy. And it won't necessarily be like, oh, but there's slightly different shapes from left to right. And maybe
could
actually be classified as two pitches, and would they be any better if they were two pitches? And you know, so like, you know, and maybe you can juice the model over time to like, oh, hey, evaluate fastball. Hey, do your own pitch classification. I've seen a couple pitch stuff models that are out there that do their own pitch classifications to see how that would change things. And like, yes, you could, you know, fiddle the dials. But the thing about being a starting pitcher is having feel for all your pitches.
Yeah.
Having feel for what the batter's doing, having feel for how your pitches look differently to different parts of the zones, having feel that may not end up in a model. You know, it's another argument for feel plus, but you know, without actual numbers on it. So
right.
When you see a guy with two pitches succeed for a while, you have to be like, well, there's probably something here I'm missing. There's probably multiple shapes on the slide. That was a big deal for a long time. Multiple shapes on the slider, right? Like you end up talking to Arrieta and he's like, oh yeah, I have two sliders. And you're like,
right.
Oh.
Ottavino and Junis did that for a bit. And yeah. Corbin did that. I think Robbie Ray at some point too, trying to slow it on the slider to make a curveball kind of stuff. Like
yeah.
That.
So there's a fine line though between that's the feel that's gotten to you here, and that's great, but mm-hmm. that feel can disappear maybe a little bit easier than having just like four very distinctly different pitches.
This is the great debate, right? It's command feel versus stuff, right?
Yeah.
And it's command 100% more finicky. And I think the tough part is figuring out who are the ones that we actually think are stable in that command area. And that's, I think, a big challenge for me is really trying to determine who are the guys that we trust to actually be at a certain level of command. Because that is a thing, right? There are those guys that we just do have the higher expectation for it. And there are others that we just don't ever expect it. And others that just kind of go back and forth. But like Justin Steele, for example, I wish I could do my soundboard of my Justin Steele impression, but he's someone absolutely that I've come around on. I actually remember last year a year ago in Florida, we did a presentation about PLV and Stuff Plus there. And a guy that we were both on the same page about, I think at the time, was like, great slider, bad fastball, right? Mm-hmm. And this was before his breakout of 2023, Justin Steele's. And I've come around on him because of exactly what you're talking about. There are two different fastballs. There are two different sliders. And he is two pitch. And as I do my rabbit ears quotes, I always call air quotes rabbit ears. I don't know why. It's just something that was told once and it's just there forever. But yeah, Justin Steele acts like a cutter inside two righties. And then actually just stay a little bit more up, I think, against lefties, while the slider has different iterations of it as well. So that has made me believe into him more. And I do trust that Justin Steele's generally going to have good command. Did he have it in his first start back? No. Is it going to be like that? Probably not. He's someone I think that I would tip the scales on. So that's going to be a fun conversation, I think, throughout this offseason, which I'm already talking about in May.
Steele. Steele is exactly what this is about. And I think the other guy that comes to mind for me is Jack Flaherty, because, you know, the disparity between his stuff numbers and his K minus BB is pretty large. With every start that he puts up these good strikeout numbers and lower walk totals, he's going to go up my rankings, because as we get more sample, I lean more towards K minus BB and more towards on field results, and further away from modeled results. And, the thing that's fascinating to me about Jack Flaherty is that, like, okay, here's a two pitch pitcher. But then I looked and I was like, wow, he throws more curves than I remember.
Yeah, he started to throw more of them. What's really interesting about Jack Flaherty, I mean, I try as much as I can to have like the back of the flashcard summary of guys. And the way I see it right now is amazing feel for the slider right now. I mean, it's incredible. It's right at the bottom of the zone and underneath, and that is just doing so much work. Sometimes a curve is there too, but the real make or break at this point for Flaherty, because he has that slider, is the fastball. Is it going to be detrimental or not? And the last two starts for Flaherty have been four seamers with extra velocity. So it was 95 on that amazing day and 94 and change recently, before it was like 93 or so. And the command of it has been far fewer mistakes, essentially, over the middle down of the plate. Those are the punished pitches from before, especially that 16K game. I mean, he just gave nothing of a gift with the four-seamer. I was able to just cook with curveballs and sliders. And the most recent one, the curveball wasn't as good, but the fastball was still well spotted around the edges. And there you go. There's success. it does make it very interesting that it has different movement. And there has been a sense for me of Lafferty's just like, I'm just going to throw my fastball in here as opposed to actually being precise around the edges with that heater. So I do wonder if there has been a shift there, and especially if he embraces that, he might be able to squeeze more out of that heater.
Yeah, I mean, I guess lefties against lefties, he's throwing the heater. Let's see here. He's throwing the heater, I would guess, more up and up and away.
Really for Flaherty? I don't love up and away. I don't know. I know a lot of guys do.
But yeah, and this research would suggest that he should throw it up and in.
Right.
Because it has different shapes to that. Right. And then against right, but he throws a lot of middle fastballs. That's weird.
Yes, he does.
And then to righties, he throws it away. So in fact, I think he's doing the opposite of what he should be doing with this fastball, because if he's getting more horizontal movement on it.
Right. Flaherty should be acting like a two seamer on this thing.
He should be throwing it like a sinker to righties, right, and like a four seam up and in, like a cutter to lefties. Either way, another fascinating thing is that Flaherty's changeup has the most drop that it's ever had in his career.
Oh, is that right?
And in the last three games, he's thrown it a fair amount. I have to switch over here to,
I'm seeing that right now. I mean, he 5% usage, 8% usage, 10% usage. And I can get that so quick because our player pages are wonderful.
Right. And I was just looking at raw. So, he's thrown it. He threw it 10 times in a start against Cleveland, seven the times before and five the time before. I mean, 17 in two games is the most he's done it, ever, according to Brooks.
That's wild.
So
let's see here. The last game he threw 10 of them had a strike rate of 40%, which is pretty bad. But he did get two outs on
pitch.
It. Yeah, he got two outs on it, which is nice. He got one out in the previous game with a 33% strike pitch, and then the five he threw. Oh, I'm so sorry about that. 43% strike rate, and then 20% strike rate. So he hasn't really been able to locate it much. But I love what you've said in the past about you throw a changeup and you show that it exists, maybe that does make the other stuff better.
The other weird thing is just that I've highlighted his velo is a big deal for Jack Flaherty.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, if you look at his velo, you know, 94.5 in the last game, 95.2 in the game before that, and then at Tampa and at Mini under 94.
Yep.
Tampa and Mini, you know, I mean, there were fine starts, especially the one against Minnesota. But Minnesota has a lot of swing and miss, and they could probably help you along on that one.
Yeah, sure.
And then the other one was his first start of the season. That was a pretty good one, but it's against the White Sox. So it's hard to like parse quality of opponent and all this. I would say that the thing that makes me most nervous about him is that I think he really needs to keep that fastball above 94, and he's had trouble doing that.
Yeah.
Now there's all this talk about cleaning up his mechanics and, you know, the Tigers. You know, the Tigers supposedly have a really strong biomechanical influence as well as sort of a game planning pitch mix influence. So like kind of separated a little bit of their pitching coaching along those lines so that somebody can work with Flaherty on his biomechanical aspects and somebody can work with them on his pitch mix and game plan approach. And both of those things seem to be really in lockstep. But, you know, what if he goes back down to 93 threes on the regular? I have a feeling that this could come down to earth pretty quickly. I don't know absolutely. That I believe in the changeup as a game changer on that regard.
Yep. I'm with you a lot. It's just so much on velocity. Could have been Jack Flaherty's mom being in the crowd in that 16K game. Amp going against the Cardinals and being like, is there a revenge game too?
Oh, definitely. Fueled by rage.
And so there's that, and then carrying that over into the next one. So, you know, I'm not sold that Flaherty is a 17% swing strike rate guy for the entirety of the season.
Yeah.
But right now, at least we understand why it's going well. After the break, I'm going to say something to you that you know, anyone listening is like, when is Nick going to mention this? And I'm going to do that after this break. You know what I'm going to say.
What's that?
You know what I'm going to say. You even tagged me in a tweet.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
You know exactly what I'm going to say. He did it!
Did he?
He did it, Ito! Yamamoto, 9 out of 39 four-seamer whiffs, all upstairs.
Oh, boy.
Thank you! Oh, man. And the funniest thing, too, is the first pitch of the game was like a down-the-pipe four-seamer to Jazz Chisholm. And Eric Samoski is like, maybe that was the moment. He's like, okay, fine. You know, Nate Pollock over there, whatever his name is, I'll listen to him finally. Thank you. I mean, I wanted to bring it back because obviously there's that kind of thing. He didn't get all the strikeouts, but he had like a 44% CSW on that four seamer. He cruised after that. It's the Marlins, whatever you want to say. But like, I hope that's a start of something for him. And the Dodgers as a whole, still, it's still a thing. I watched the Walker Buehler game.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to really actually talk about that one with you because this is a very interesting conversation to me where Yamamoto, you're going to be great. It's great. Hopefully he's amazing. Awesome. Blah, blah, blah. I need the slider and cutter to show up too. That'd be great. Swell. But just to keep throwing four seamers up there. Okay. This Walker Buehler start was 4 innings, like 3 runs against the Marlins. And what's crazy is that the stuff is clearly good still, right? Like it's 95, 96 on his four seamer. He has this 90, 91. Was this the bullet cutter that people like, the bullet slider? Mm-hmm. Is that what they're trying to call it? It's a cutter. It's really good. And he has a changeup they didn't show. There's a curveball. There's a slider. There's all this stuff in there. And it wasn't executed. And I felt like the whole game plan was weird. And I'm really curious what your takeaway was from Walker Buehler's return. Is it just like, it's what I call a still ill, right? You don't really start guys in their first game back because there's all this extra noise in the way and before they get into rhythm. Like, where are you on Walker Buehler right now?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at his IVB and it's where it was. And his velo is above where it was before the injury. So he's feeling froggy. And I like that part. What hurts me in analysis is that he threw the cutter more than he threw his fastball or seamer. And so I just wonder, you know, if this is according to Savant. I don't know if Fangraphs has it differently.
I have it. Yeah. 30% cutters, 29% four seamer.
Okay. So pretty close. The thing that makes that difficult to kind of parse is that Stuff Plus is going to take the fastball that is thrown the most, the hard pitch that's thrown the most, and define everything off of it.
Oh, right? No.
And so because he threw the cutter more, his Stuff Plus was 96.
Yeah.
And it loved his cutter, 105, but I think that made the slider 108 Stuff Plus worse.
Right.
I wonder if that's the best approach for him. Because if you think about standing in against him, if he's going to throw the cutter more than the four seam and you sit cutter, then could you, off of sitting cutter, react better to slider and curve?
Well, here's the thing.
Because Nick, you're like, everything's going to bend.
Nick Gordon hit a home run on a cutter that was upstairs. And you could see he was actually maybe not even sitting cutter. He's probably sitting fastball. Mm. But then it just kind of like, it was upstairs, but really like middle upper. And he just flung the bat out and Nick Gordon hit a home run. Nick Gordon hit a home run.
Right. Okay.
It's what I call the Cannibal McSanchez. It's the old Sanchez and Colin McHugh would try to do high cutters to get called strikes.
Yeah.
You know what the difference is between Buehler and those guys? They didn't have a 95, 96 mile per hour four seamer. This is their way to
get. That's what I don't
get.
That's right. What I don't get. Why didn't
it make any sense? Don't do this approach. Just throw your four seamer there.
This is like an old man approach, right?
Right. And Tyone, I mean, I'm going back to this because there's so many things. And I'm sorry I didn't record this, guys. I didn't do it as a podcast or a video. I just wanted to sit there and just chill with them for 45 minutes. Uh-huh. And it was the best. And one moment we talked about his cutter, where I joked that he threw it against Brandon Marsh last year and hit a home run in the perfect spot. And he's like, yeah, I stopped doing that. I was like, but it's really good in this way. He's like, well, I actually realized, like, why am I throwing my cutter there if not my four seamer? Because his cutter is more like a gyro slider. It's like going down, right? It's not a a Wade Miley coming into the batter.
Why do I throw something that might fall into?
Right. As opposed to, it's not going in off the plate. It's just going to go back in the zone. So might as well just throw my four seamer there. It's way better. I'm like, oh, actually, that's a really good point. I'm with you. And looking at Buehler's cutter, it's the same thing, right? It's a one that goes down. It's not really a aggressive horizontal movement. It's more vertical down. So in that case, yeah, throw four seamers there, Buehler. Don't be going for that. And then lean on that cutter as a sharper down and away pitch, or really just honestly in the zone lower, that when they're thinking about this four seamer, like, great, cool, you have this one to steal a strike in the zone. That's fine. But don't make it this high upstairs thing, because you have the four seamer to do that. It really boggled my mind, because like the ones he threw down and away to right-handers, which he moved away from, were so filthy. These 90 mile per hour ones, 91. Oh, I loved it. And then he just like, whatever, I'm just going to go upstairs now.
But also, you know, just like that idea that like maybe you can keyhole him to everything.
Yeah.
Like to being a breaking ball guy where everything is going in that direction. Whereas, you know, if with the four seam, you know, at least you have, like in terms of what he has that he threw that has arm side movement, it was the four seam, the sinker, and the change, which was about 50%, but that doesn't mean that it felt like 50%, you know, to certain batters, especially since you're only going to throw those nine sinkers basically to righties. So especially as a lefty, if you can say, well, he's not going to throw the four seam as much and he's going to be cutter, slider, curve, like everything's coming in on me.
Sure.
So I'm just going to sort of look outer half.
Yeah.
You know, look outer half and adjust to ones that come over the plate and hit those tank, you know. So maybe Nick Gordon was looking for four seam outer half and hit the home run because he got cutter in.
It's the most like, oh, swing. Like, and what's interesting too is how he uses a sinker. Buehler was going down with it, right? He was trying to get like low down and away sinkers to right-handers. I don't know if I really love that. I'm more about that jamming inside kind of thing. So it's like one step forward, one step back, I think, with the Dodgers. It's like, Yamamoto, hey, is this a thing now? Please tell me this is a thing now. And then I see Buehler, and you had 2 years, right? Like, he didn't even pitch last year. They're thinking about prepping him for this, but it's 2 years later, and we often see it coming back from Tommy John that guys are different. We saw Tarek Skubal look completely different.
Right.
We saw Mize look different. I mean, even Reagans was saying that he looked different. Tyone talks about how he was completely different. We learned his mechanics and stuff during Tommy John. Like, we see this constantly. Guys get these new moments to correct anything that they want, and really just, what else are they going to do? Just study, study, study. And I'm seeing like, no, this doesn't work. You have such good stuff. Like, really, it is. It's crazy to me. And
it seems like he focused more on sort of getting back to where he was rather than
them readjusting all of it. Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing that really improved when he went away and came back.
So what didn't improve was sticky stuff being gone, because some writer decided to expose it to everybody. What a dingus. I mean, if you look at, like,
did you see that in the Sonny Gray thing?
No, I didn't actually. Really? Did he mention this?
Yeah. It's the first interview that I've had where a guy was like, well, after sticky stuff, I had to change. And I was like, wow. Okay. So we're now in the part where we can just talk about that as like a bygone era. So,
right. Well, I mean, this was such a huge thing for Walker Buehler. It was an 18 vert in 2020, 2021. It came down to 16 in 2022.
And it hasn't gone back.
And yeah, it was 16 again here. Now, he's also a flat four-seamer guy, though. Like 93rd percentile height-adjusted VAA, which essentially says, hey, look, this four-seamer should be upstairs. I mean, it's pretty straightforward in that way for me. But what does he do? He kind of located a lot of them in the middle. And a few of them were upstairs, and he actually had two whiffs on his four seamer. One of them was a four seamer that like the glove was down in a way. And I don't know if that was the intent or not. Like some guys, they just ride up. Like Tyon was that guy. He was saying, yeah, I put it down in a way and it rides up. Like Jake Odorizzi used to do. Is that what Buehler does with his? I don't know. It was beautiful though. It was like 97 right out of the zone and they swung and missed. Like, yeah, that's you should see that as a pitcher and go, oh, hmm. And like, he's not.
Yeah, you know, there's a stat on Old Brooks that's like average pitch location.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that, you know, it was better than he's ever done, obviously because it was one game or whatever. But in terms of like yearly average, it's up. But then you look at the heat maps and you're like, oh, he had four waist pitches that were like, you know, a foot above the zone and not shouldn't be like, that's why Hylock is you know, superior. Yeah, because it's a percentage. And so for him, of all the four seamers he threw, he only threw four in the top third in the zone.
Yeah.
And
so, and one of them was like way out and should be completely and not considered. One was kind of middle, but like barely in that top third. So just two that are actually competitive upstairs.
Oh, interesting. Really. I'm looking at the heat map. It says it looks like the four are right, but.
Oh, yeah. Maybe one is just one ridiculous one. I'm like, oh boy.
Yeah, but yeah. And then like two middle, like four middle, middle.
Yeah.
Or middle, middle, which is like, okay.
You know, you're right. I have it still set as right-handers. So yeah, that was against right-handers. There you go. Beautiful.
Yeah, so four top third, four middle, middle, four super, super waist.
Yeah.
So this doesn't seem great. But, I forgot. Oh, so Sonny Gray in this thing was talking about how, like, when he held his curveball, when he held his sweeper.
He held his curveball for a sweeper, yeah.
When he held his sweeper, this is his, like, rip.
It's like I know. Right. Yeah.
It's like
crazy.
It's super weird.
This is the Yankee version. This is Tyon said this to me. This is the Yankee
Tanaka. Tanaka. Yeah. It all comes from Tanaka.
This is what they teach him like this. It's like so what we're doing right now, we're essentially putting our index finger and middle finger. Middle finger is kind of in the middle.
It's like there's no seams almost.
Yeah. It's like and then your index finger is in between the backwards C. So essentially what you're doing is your index finger goes against the base of the backwards C as you come across, and your middle finger is against the right side of the two seam. And you throw it like that.
And it's like really kind of spread of it. Finger. It's spread finger.
It makes it's no like sense.
A spread finger sideways curveball without a seam.
Right. It makes no sense. I'm really all for the Chaz Rowe version, which is your middle finger pressed against the bottom of the backwards C. And you just really push your index finger into your middle finger to get as much spin as you can sideways off of that spin. Seam. Right.
Well, so what he was talking about was the thumb placement. And he said that with sticky stuff, he had his thumb maybe at the bottom or something. And he had to move his thumb out of the way, he said.
Out of the way, okay.
So I think he had his thumb at the bottom. And because his fingers were, and this is also interesting, you don't have a seam to grip the ball, right?
Yeah, right.
So the idea was with sticky stuff was, well, your hand is attached to the ball.
Right. Oh my gosh.
And he said that after sticky stuff, it popped around this thumb.
Oh, interesting.
And it popped and it still got lots of sweep, but it was like 82.
Yeah.
And he was like, how do I not have this pop without having my fingers attached to the ball anymore?
Right, right.
And so he moved the thumb up.
Oh, interesting.
So now he throws it kind of like this.
That is so
side.
Man, I can't. I'm trying to think like how high you can go with your thumb because then you just feel like I'm not holding the thing, you know?
Yeah. But it's on the side. It's more on the side of the ball now, and it's a sideways breaking ball.
Anyway, just admitting
that he used to use sticky stuff was
right.
I mean, I love pitchers, man, because like, what are you gonna do? Like, yeah, I don't use it anymore, so I can't get busted. And
of course,
I'm talking about a time before
everyone used it.
Yeah, exactly. So
everyone used it. It's fine.
You know, we've had some really honest moments in the past too about what went wrong in New York and stuff, and you know.
Well, I mean that's a fun conversation too. I mean, I remember seeing some ridiculous quotes to me, and I would love for you to verify some of them. And also, there's another pitcher that I think we should talk about here, and we're going to talk about all of that after this break. So I remember seeing a quote that Sonny Gray, when he was in New York, the Yankees told him, hey, you get a lot of spin on your four seamer, thus you should throw it upstairs. And that to me, I mean, I'm hoping you can validate that, or you've heard anything like that or not. But that to me is so wrong, because yes, he has spin, but he has spin that forces it to drop, not to stay up. It's the opposite version of the spin that you want for a high four seamer.
It's high spin, low efficiency.
Right. So that means it's a cutter, really, yeah, to me. And the four seams you throw upstairs are the ones that you have high efficiency. So then you get vert on it. But I just heard the quote as, you have high spin, thus upstairs. It's like, no, wait, that's the opposite one, though.
Yeah. And I wonder if that was just a 1 year blip, or if it was a mm-hmm. communication issue. I do think that at times the Yankees have had communications issues. I think they do a fair amount of siloing, where people just work on different things. And so, you know, somebody, you know, with his head down was like, you know, boom, 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 you know, maybe it was misunderstood or miscommunicated. And that's how it got to Sonny. I trust the Yankees to understand the difference between, you know, a high spin, high vert, and a high spin, you know, non-high vert. One thing that's kind of fascinating was, you know, nomenclature was a big deal for us in the discussion with Sonny, and he was using the word slider for like four different pitches. And I was like, dude, we just have to call it a sweeper so we know which one we're talking about, you know. And one of the revelations for him was, when he got out of there in Cincinnati, was just call your four-seam a cutter. And then you'll understand how to use it better. Well, that's interesting, because he also has a cutter now. But the cutter is more of a gyro slider.
Right.
So I don't know if I fully got this across in the piece, because it's just a linguistic mess to like talk to him, because everything he does, like I talked about how when he puts his hand down on the table, his index finger doesn't make it to the table, you know?
Really?
Yeah, like he's been shaped by all the breaking balls he's thrown.
So is it like just pulled up, or is it bent, or is
it just like this?
It's just okay. So it's just tilted over, like hand, and then you just tilt it slightly toward the pinky.
It's like, think about putting his hand flat on.
Yeah, yeah, that's wild. So he's just an ultra supinator.
Yeah, and so you know, of course he has a million different breaking balls, but I think that the way I think about it is, he has a cut fastball, a gyro slider that he now, instead of thinking as a gyro slider, he switched to thinking as a cutter.
Right.
But that's not his four seam, which he treats as like a cut fastball, but it's a cutter. So it's
like Gallen would do that. Yeah.
So we'll just call the cutter a gyro slider, because that makes more sense. But he does try to stay behind it.
Right.
But on the four seam, he just thinks four seam, but it also cutter, because it's kind of a cutter. And so then he throws the gyro slider, and then there's a sweeper, and then there's a curveball, which is a little bit more 12 to 6 than the sweeper.
Right. Oh, man. I love him. He's looking so good right now, Sonny Gray. It's really, he's one of those pitchers to me that it's almost like he's a kitchen sink guy. And he's very much of, hey, please do not do anything with this sinker or fastball, right? Like, it's just, I got to get to the sweeper, I got to get to the curveball.
They're kind of like, oh, I've been breaking balling you to death, and here's the four seam.
Yeah, right, right.
Sinker, you know, like he still throws the changeup sometimes. But here's a thing that's newsworthy and of the time. Sonny Gray was pitching yesterday. And Wilson Contreras was told to kind of inch closer to the plate to get frame more strikes at the bottom of the zone. And it was kind of gruesome to watch. Looked broken right away.
Yeah.
Broke his forearm on the, you know, JD Martinez was just swinging normally. I don't think JD Martinez has that bad of a backswing. So broke his arm. I wonder, as a pitcher, like, wouldn't you be in like a little bit? I think I'd be angry at the organization a little bit.
Why?
Just let me throw my crap. Like, do I need these called strikes in the bottom zone that bad that you're going to risk my catcher's health?
Well, yeah, no, I'd be. There's been a memo
from the organization, like, right. Kylie McDaniels reported there was a memo from MLB saying, don't move your catchers closer.
Yeah, right. It makes sense. Because, I mean, when you have someone like Sonny Gray who has so much drop, and he's living so low. Like, I mean, it's like Dallas Keuchel, essentially, this kind of thing of like the neckbeard almost of they're dropping so much and you can seal those strikes.
Yeah, I guess intellectually you could like make sense of it, but then like emotionally there might be a little like, come on, man, let's just
do we have any vibranium we can put on the form of, of catchers?
No, just
but like all right, you get up one hit fine or whatever per game based on this because they get it, you know.
What about a catcher's box?
I mean, we have one technically. Like, you're not supposed to. I mean, look, the catcher's box. I understand.
Is there a line drawn for the catcher? No.
Well, it's essentially you're not supposed to be anywhere higher than. Oh, that's interesting. Actually, there's one up front. I'm thinking of the plate, but like obviously not the plate.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. No,
you draw two batter's boxes. Like I do the field for infield for Little League all the time. I don't know that Little League is exactly the same as the majors, but like you draw two batter's boxes, and then in some bullpens there's a little line for where the catcher should set up. But
well, sure, but there's also, I mean, it's not necessarily just where the feet are though; it's where the arm is. You know, like you sometimes guys pulling back. Like let's say it's a high curveball, you pull back.
Right.
And then if it's low, you go out as far as.
So even if we draw a catcher's box, because somebody with long arms could be
That's like
I'm
a,
out
you know,
here.
Trust me, I'm looking right now. I'm like, that's a foot or two. So
catcher's box, you have to keep your arm inside of.
Right, and I also imagine a lot more batters.
This is how baseball is going to react if like. Because remember, Buster Posey had the big, crash, and then like we were like, okay, we're preventing
injuries as much as we can. So,
yeah.
And thing too is that more batters, I would imagine, are going to be further back in the box just to give them a little extra timing on heaters that are so high. Maybe it's something where we are more rigorous on how far back batters can go. Because I mean, how many times
the line gets obscured and they
right? So many times they do that on purpose. They rub the line, they go on that, and it's like. What if you actually made a nub on the field for how far back the foot can go? Yeah,
like a semi permanent sort of thing.
Yeah, it's just like you can't, and you're not going to want to do this. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't have like a wall because then like how's the back going to go through? It's gonna have like a little thing, like a little rubber on our side. You know?
If ABS happens, then the catcher can be like 5 feet.
Oh yeah, well right. Then that's the simple solution. Who cares if ABS is a good guy? I mean, then again, you'd want the batter to have to challenge. Still, there'll be some game of framing that still exists. You want them to like not.
Oh, that's interesting. Like that. You'd want I mean, if it's a challenge system, you'd want. You'd
right.
Want
the, which I'm all for, by the way. Huge shout out to a scout that essentially said like. He was asking me about like automated strike zone. I told him that I like the challenge system of tennis. He had his doubts. And then I saw him again this year and he was like, well, you know, you were right.
I think I know that.
Oh, of course you do. You suggested it last year and it's great. if you know who I'm talking about, that is the greatest impression of that person that you'll ever
get. It's pretty good.
Yeah. but he's a believer in the ABS system now. I am too. I think it's also like you see with schemes.
Well, not
quickly
full
done.
ABS. I mean, we've seen walk rates and strikeout rates both explode.
Yeah.
And I had some pushback from listeners on Rates and Barrels about, you know, how could both things be true? But I think it makes some sense in terms of just both hitters and pitchers are trying to deal with something new and don't know how
they're trying to
deal
with it. Perfect.
Yeah.
You know,
and so hitters will let balls go that haven't been called strikes in the past.
Right.
And they'll be called strikes.
Yeah.
But pitchers will go places where they've been given space before.
Yep.
And so it's all an adjustment period. But what's interesting is that baseball, in the effort of like A/B testing and figuring this out, is going to keep changing it. And so if you keep changing it, then batters and pitchers are always trying to just figure it out. And so on some level, you have to just leave it alone for 3 years and see what
this
happens.
This is the problem of what we do. You know, the game changes so fast. When we finally know something, it's like, nope, never mind. The ball is changed.
We try to model things.
Gone. Yeah. We've got pitch clock here. We've got different base sizes. We've got new dimensions of Baltimore is different.
Oh my God! Have you noticed the Cleveland Park factors?
No.
Cleveland is the number one friendliest park for home runs this year on one-year park factors, which is
what changed?
Normally don't look at one-year park factors.
Yeah, but what changed? What's going on?
But they lopped off they lopped off a bunch of seating, which changes the airflow.
Get out of here!
It does. It literally changes.
There's an actual jet stream.
It's totally possible. I mean, if you read this great piece by Mike Betriello about the Ted Williams home or the red seat, you know, I was talking to somebody who worked for that company, and he said that there's a Wind Applied Metrics. It's this company that models wind for baseball. And if you've watched TV cast where they say, oh, that was aided by wind by 10 feet, that's them.
Right. The Cubs broadcast does that at times. I love it. It is so good.
And so what he said was, with Fenway's current dimensions, that 530-foot homer probably would have only gone 480. So we're talking about 50 feet because Fenway was 30 feet shorter back then. And the ball could actually get up out. Like if you think of a stadium.
Right, contained.
The way the wind goes is it goes in and it hits the bleachers and comes back and gives pitchers a tailwind.
Right.
And actually goes against balls in flight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you have a short stadium where a ball can actually leave that wind flow pattern, it can actually just join the prevailing winds above.
Yeah, yeah, and it's stale up there, and it has.
Yeah. Oh,
so wait, that's what happened in Cleveland.
Happening in Cleveland. The thing is, we don't model wind, so we don't know. Yeah, I mean, maybe
why
I
not,
can get
right?
them to. Maybe I can get them to tell me something.
I mean,
now they work with baseball, so like,
okay, hold on a second.
They don't necessarily. That you have to like get approval, and like, it's not like I can just text them and be like, "Hey, what is actually going on in Cleveland?"
Well, no, there must be an API.
There could be something going on in Cleveland.
Right. we can probably get purchase API data for like wind patterns in stadiums, right?
That's kind of some of it. But the real problem with wind is that you can get prevailing wind pretty easily, which is just sort of like which way is the wind going in that area. But when you start talking about big structures, what's really important is the tiny little wind things.
Yeah.
And when you like, you've seen this on the Cubs broadcast where they show the wind patterns and their arrows going in all sorts of directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's little eddies and stuff and little.
Sure.
You know, and it's a major source of noise for batted balls.
Oh man.
You're talking about 10 feet difference, 10, 15 feet difference, depending on the wind in a certain little direction.
That's absurd. I will look further into this. I am very sorry for what I'm about to say. This is the most vulgar thing I'm ever going to say on any of these podcasts. I know. Look at this. No, it's not. It's fine. It is. I wish the story about the Guardians, you know, taking on this breeze that's going on was called Breaking Wind.
breaking wind. Well, you know, what's silly about it is that, like, I don't know if it's already happened, and I'm not just disparaging anybody who's written about it or is thinking about it this way. It may be true too, is that there's going to be a sort of desire to explain Cleveland's offensive outburst as, oh, this is the culmination of a great process of getting bat to ball guys and like adding power later.
Yeah.
And who knows how much of that is true and how much is just wind.
I mean, this goes back to the whole thing about like defensive metrics and the Dodgers having the best BABIPs for years because they're really good at shifts.
Despite the fact that shifting is like now
more
limited. They still have the best BABIP this year.
Yeah, because they understand
a completely different pitching staff, right?
Yeah. But I mean, with shifting, I still see so many times in the shortstops fielding the ball past second base. Like, that still happens.
They stand over close to it, and as the play evolves, they go.
Yeah, right.
And then there was this interesting finding that batting average on outfield balls has dipped further during the shift era than batting average on infield balls.
No surprise.
So just the stuff that we do with our outfielders
is
huge, and there's no limits on that. So you can do that. I think that if you want to know like how extreme outfield shifts can be, you should watch a game in San Francisco because there's this big triples alley, small right field, and a big sort of expansive outfield with temperature that kills the ball flight. So there's a lot of outs in that outfield, and people do a lot of funky things where I think the right fielder plays in Triple's alley, which is kind of right center.
Yeah.
The center fielder then patrols, you know, left center and center. Right. And then the right fielder, the left fielder just gets like the line.
You know, one thing I don't want to forget that I didn't mention before. I mean, there's all these random tidbits. It's just going to be like throughout my entire life. Like, oh, yeah, I remember that one thing that Dion said that one time.
Yeah.
I brought up to him like that Nelson Figueroa had this podcast with us where he talked about the mounds at Citi Field being higher in the bullpen. And they felt so good. And then they would come out of the mound. And Tyler says, yeah, that's like San Francisco. I'm like, what do you mean San Francisco?
Oh, they do it too?
And he's like, well, they used to. They fixed it. But they used to have the mound for the bullpen on the opposing team off-centered. Like, it wasn't great. It wasn't the rubber to the home plate was slightly off. He was like, you've got to be kidding me. It's like, no, that was like, that's a known thing. It was like, oh, it's like, oh my gosh.
That's with Trevor May last week, we looked at weird park factors. And one of the things we found was that the batter's eye in Seattle is off center.
What?
Yeah.
Man, I wonder if there's
Oscar Hernandez when he said, I could never feel like I was getting straight to the pitcher.
Oh my gosh. No way.
It's because the bleachers and the batter's eye kind of point towards third base a little bit. So if as a right hander, you're like looking towards the batting eye and you're like, what? How do I,
you know, slowly turning in his chair?
Yeah, how do I line this up? I can't. What?
Oh my gosh. I mean, would that explain why the Mariners offense is always what?
I think it does explain why people go to Seattle and have a really hard time. Part of it, I mean, then
the park factor too,
temperature is a big park factor, and if they have the doors open, then it's cold. You know,
there a big split between pitchers in Safeco versus like their starters home road? I hate home road splits, but is there a larger one than we expect? I'm curious about that. Maybe we'll think about that the next time, because we're running out of time here, and I want to give you a moment here, you know, just to tell us what you're working on this week, what we can when are you doing your next pitcher rankings?
I should probably do those mid-May. Okay. I'll do those.
We'll have an episode talking about that.
I have a piece today up that's about using Stuff Plus and Pitching Plus to evaluate hitters so far.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what's interesting is we talk here about Stuff Plus and the limitations of Location Plus and how it doesn't it doesn't become sticky quickly and it has a lot of noise. It's not sticky year to year, but if you're evaluating hitters, that's irrelevant. So I've seen a lot of people being like, these hitters have faced the best Stuff Plus, and that's cool. But actually, what you should be looking at is which hitters have faced the best PLV or which hitters have faced the best Pitching Plus.
There you go.
Because that's what matters as a hitter.
Exactly.
Location matters as a hitter. And you're not talking about if it's sticky or not. You're talking about who has faced the nastiest crap.
Right.
And I made a list today of who's faced the nastiest crap by Pitching Plus. And it is absolutely all the guys that are struggling that you think are on the list that you're like, I don't get it. You know, why is this guy? And then you look at the list and you're like, holy crap.
Oh, there it is. Right.
These guys have seen.
And this is this is the thing I've been like when I first started the whole.
Yeah, I totally thought of you when I
think the whole transition or really the journey was like, yeah, this guy's going against a lefty and he's against lefties today, but maybe he gets the biggest gift of a fastball and he hits that. Or like this guy goes against the guy that we don't think is very good, but he happens to see the best version of that guy, you know, or he's the one who gets the three nastiest sliders of that day. Right.
And like, I've in fact seen some research that really the job of being a great hitter is actually just destroying the bad pitches.
Yes. Yes. Taking advantage of mistakes. Right.
And that's some
huge.
And if you're the better you get as a hitter, the more you inspire bad pitches,
because you get pitchers nervous.
Being essentially, finer, they like, can't be near.
Right. I remember you talking about this with Aaron Judge being like, Aaron Judge actually doesn't see the best pitches or so.
Yeah.
Like the best, you would think that. I mean, sometimes guys do step up, but it also works in their favor too, right?
We know that we know that as you become more established, think about Chris Davis with a C.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did not have a good sense of the zone, but as he was a feared hitter with a capital F, capital H, they were further and further from the center of the zone, and it was easier for him to spit on those pitches and get walked.
And just be like, I'm going to wait for this one.
But then the switch flipped, and he was not a feared hitter anymore, and the walk rate disappeared. Yeah. I think it happened to Pujols, too.
So
I thought this was just a real thing. And then Monday, big piece coming. There's some interesting metrics coming to a public site that is that we all go on very regularly.
Wow, Pitcherless. I didn't know this. So what's
it's an arm of the state, I guess I could say.
Well, there you go.
I got to take a little quick look at them, and so I've got some stuff coming on that on Monday.
No, it's going to be awesome. Looking forward to that. I've said it before, I'll say it again. PLV is a hitting stat, not a pitching stat. I know it sounds crazy. But it is.
When I made this list, I was like, holy crap. I did the top 15, and there's three guys out of 15 that are doing okay.
Mm, yeah.
The other 12 are struggle bunnies.
Right. And then we can say, cool, what are your decision values? What are your hitter performance, essentially?
Yeah, at some point, too. Right. Like, I don't know where the sample is where I want to do this, but like, who does well against the nastiest pitches? I would assume. Welcome.
Come on in. Come join
you
us.
You know who I assume?
Let's have a great time.
Juan Soto.
And oh yeah, of course.
Because he takes them.
Yeah. Alvarez
would be my guess. My guess is just the people that do the best against the nastiest pitches take them.
Yeah. Corey Seager too. Really good at this. By the way, we're actually going to be having our minor league app that utilizes this, because I think that's the hardest thing to judge is hitter performance in the minors. And to be able to say what quality pitches are they seeing relative to major league pitching, that is going to be a huge eye opener for us about prospect assessment. That's going to be available by the end of the month for PL Pro users. So we're super stoked about that one. We're going to have a longer conversation about all that stuff. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. But that's going to do it for this episode of The Craft. You know, can't thank you enough for being here once again. My name is Nick Pollock, and we'll talk about The Craft again next week.